07-7009. Ali Fadala, Belhaf El, Helen Yaaman, former head of Army Intelligence Israel. Mr. Chomsky, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Weiner, for the application.
May it please the court, I'm Judith Chomsky. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, seeking the reversal of the dismissal by the district court below. This case involves the interpretation of two statutes, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the Torture Victim Protection Act. The court's role as to each statute is to interpret it according to its plain language and to interpret it, the statute as a whole. The complaint sets out a prima facie case under the TVPA. The plaintiffs have pled that the defendant is a former general in the Israeli army. At the time of the relevant acts, he was acting under color of foreign law, that he participated in the intended killing of the plaintiffs through an attack on a UN compound in Khanna, Lebanon, where unarmed civilians.
Do you have any Torture Victim Protection Act or Alien Tort Action cases where the firing decisions of a military officer have been brought into a U.S. court?
Not specifically that, Your Honor, but of course, we have had cases involving actions that were taken in the course of conflict. This is what.
This is no more than assuming, now you're, I'm reading your complaint pretty charitably to even get you to a firing decision. It looks as if about all you've alleged is he was a high-ranking officer at the time a conflict was going on. But even reading it that he's a decision maker for this event, it looks like a firing decision. That's the kind of thing that would seem to be at the core of protected sovereign immunity.
Your Honor, I believe that what we've alleged is an intentional attack on unarmed civilians, which is a violation of Israeli law. Israeli law, the conduct of the defendant in participating in the.
Israel doesn't seem to think so.
Your Honor.
Do you have a diplomatic letter in the file here?
Yes, we do. And I'd like to address the letter and the extent to which this court should give deference to the letter. The letter recognizes that this is a suit against the defendant personally, trying to hold the defendant personally liable. It recognizes it is not the TVPA claim in particular, is not a claim against the State of Israel. The letter.
I'm troubled by the idea you're advancing that the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act does not cover government officials, covers them only until the day they leave office. Where did you get that from?
I am persuaded by the decision of the Supreme Court in Dole Food Company versus Patrickson.
That really has nothing to do with the question I'm asking you. We're talking here about a government official who, like all government officials, presumably serves for a finite period. Now, you really expect us to write a precedent that says Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act covers governments and their officials and their official conduct until the day they leave office, and then you can sue them all over the world? in any court in the world?
As I understand the precedence of this court, a individual official is protected by the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act because the official is a agent or instrumentality of the state.
And you're saying that protection ends, though, at the end of their term of service?
I believe that that is what Dole says, and I think the fact...
Dole was not dealing with that question at all, was it? Wasn't Dole a corporation, and the question was whether it was government-owned?
That was one of the questions dealt with in Dole.
What's another question in Dole that's relevant here?
The other question in Dole is whether the immunity continues after the entity ceases to be an instrumentality of the state.
With reference to ownership of a corporation. That was the only issue in Dole, wasn't it? There was not a government official in Dole, was it?
It is correct that it was not a government official.
The only defendant in Dole was a corporation, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now,
but
the only issue had to do with the ownership of the corporation.
Yes, but I believe that the fact that in this case it's a natural person and not a corporate entity is dealt with in Dole, because Dole specifically distinguished the FSIA immunity from the kinds of immunity that are available to domestic officials in the United States. That's why Dole rejected reliance on Nixon versus Fitzgerald and on the other qualified immunity cases. The court looked to the purpose of the FSIA.
What was the purpose found?
Excuse me?
What was the purpose affirmatively found in Dole?
That the purpose of the FSIA was comedy.
And how does comedy play out in this context?
In this context, a suit against a former official personally does not haul the foreign sovereign into court. It is not...
Suppose that Henry Kissinger or Bill Clinton is sued in the courts of Belgium for conduct performed while in office and clearly within the scope of their authorities. Would it be consistent with comedy for the courts of Belgium to rule on that case?
Your Honor, if the Torture Victim Protection Act, which is the decision of our Congress, somehow...
But let's assume for the moment that the FSIA and the Torture Victim Protection Act can be reconciled without either of them having a hole dug in it, which I think is the case. So you still have to resolve it on the basis of the FSIA and a notion of comedy, and I'm just trying to explore what comedy, what we might expect by way of comedy.
I think it's clear, for instance, from the Pinochet decision in England, that there are certain kinds of conduct which make an official of a foreign country amenable to suit even in another country,
That's a different question than the question of whether foreign sovereign immunity evaporates upon the day a person leaves office. Pinochet had, in fact, left office, but that doesn't seem to be why he was being held amenable to suit, does it? Was that essential to the British court's decisions? Assuming the British court has some persuasive value.
Yeah. I believe that that issue was not addressed in the Pinochet decision.
Right. That's really not on point.
But I think the fact that it's a natural person as opposed to a corporation is addressed in the Dole decision, because
where in Dole do you find that
address? I believe at I can quote the language, but I don't have the page. Oh, I'm sorry. It's at 48 of the 480 of I'm sorry, I have the, I don't have the U.S. Court site, but here's what the court said. There, in Nixon versus Fitzgerald, the president was immune from liability for official actions taken during his time in office, even against a suit filed when he was no longer serving in that capacity. And the court goes on, the concern in domestic immunity cases is the diversion of energies which interfere with the effective function of the U.S. government. It also reflects the constitutional separation of power. Dole concluded that that rationale is not implicated in statutory immunity under the FSIA. This court has never found that the FSIA extended to former officials.
At the next sentence in Dole, after what you read, deals with the relationship between the corporation and the government. So again, their distinction is recognizing that that case dealt with a corporate entity and not a government official, aren't they? Maybe especially in the part that you're the distinction of the Nixon decision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I do not deny at all that the defendant in that case was a corporation. What I am talking about is the analysis of the court in Dole for the reason of the applicability of
the
foreign
Tennessee
sovereign immunity.
Would not be entitled to instrumentality status, even on if their theory that instrumentality status could be conferred on a subsidiary were accepted. The whole discussion does not have relevance to what this notion that somehow a government official's immunity terminates when they leave office. Would our judicial immunity terminate if we decided to resign this manager?
It would, Your Honor, and precisely because the reason for extending immunity to federal officials is distinct from the reason for extending immunity in the instance of a foreign sovereign. If I may, Your Honor, it is clear that these suits are suits against the individual personally, that Congress has specifically permitted such suits, and that is clear under the language of the TVPA. And if the TVPA were
really concerned also about us writing a precedent that says a firing decision of a combat commander, firing decision of the head of an Army unit possibly responsible for fire on a particular target comes under the Torture Victim Protection Act? Does that accurately state your position?
It states our position in close to our position, but not precisely our position.
Correct me.
That is, the decision to fire on a UN compound and an unarmed civilian to intentionally do that is within the TVPA's prohibition against extrajudicial killing, and that it is contrary to Israeli law, which is relevant both to the issue of the defendant's protection, the application of the TVPA and the FSIA.
You have of what this putative defendant did that's a violation of TVPA is where in your complaint?
I'm sorry. It's alleged in the complaint that the plaintiff participated in the decision. The defendant
participated in a decision.
Where are we in the complaint?
I'm sorry. I don't have the specific language. I'll be happy to present it to the court during my rebuttal time. Yes.
Okay.
to sue a state and to reach the assets of a foreign state, a plaintiff would be required to bring a claim under the FSIA and initiate that claim by service under Section 1608. This is, the TVPA is a suit against an individual in his personal capacity, and to be brought before the court in a TVPA action, a plaintiff must be within the jurisdiction of the court or subject to its long-arm statute. No case has required a suit under the TVPA to be initiated by 1608, and that is because it is clear that the TVPA does not permit a suit against a state, and that is...
Your time is up.
I'm sorry.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, I'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Robert Weiner, representing General Yalone. I'd like to introduce Mr. Martin Peled Flax, who's Minister Counselor of the Embassy of Israel, who is observing today. And I'd like to address some of the arguments that the plaintiffs presented. First of all, Your Honor, plaintiffs argue that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does not apply to former officials. The first point is that they didn't raise that argument below, and so the court need not reach it, although the court has discretion to if it wishes.
Is there any particular reason we should exercise our discretion one way or the other?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the rule against considering issues not raised below is a rule that goes to judicial efficiency. If the plaintiffs had a meritorious argument, which I argue strenuously they do not, and the district court did not have an opportunity to consider it, then it wastes the time of the Court of Appeals and the parties to have them raise that issue on appeal and have to go back down and start over again. So there is an institutional interest in having and insisting, except in highly unusual cases, that plaintiffs raise issues below if they want to rely on them to reverse the judgment of the district court. Now, the FSIA prohibits a lawsuit against a foreign state. And the Dole case deals with the definition of instrumentality and agency in Section 1603B, and it refers to that in a corporate context. That is not the only way that a foreign official can be considered subject to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. In the Transero case, this court, in an opinion by Judge Santel, this court considered whether the military, the Air Force of Bolivia, fit within 1603A as the equivalent of a foreign state, or 1603B as an instrumentality. And in that case, it made a difference because the incidents were different with regard to the service process consequences. The court said that because the military was a core governmental function, suing the Air Force of Bolivia was equivalent to suing the state. The military was the foreign state, and it fit under 1603A. And I submit, Your Honors, that that is true, whether the defendant is 1,000 officials, as in, or 10,000 or more, or one official. The issue is, what function are they carrying out?
I mean, Ms. Chomsky made the point that, she didn't quite make this point, but she could have, that there the suit was effectively against the treasury of the government of Bolivia, which is not, at least nominally, the case here.
Well, Your Honor, the State of Israel has sent a letter, a formal communication to the Department of State, in which it says that this suit is in reality a suit against the State of Israel challenging a sovereign act that was authorized and carried out by the State of Israel. Under those circumstances, bless you, Your Honor, under those circumstances, it is inconceivable and really defies reality to suggest that this case is not against Israel, that Israel is not responsible. And indeed, under the UN articles dealing with the responsibility of states for internationally wrongful acts, states are responsible for the acts of their employees. So the Dole case was an interpretation of 1603B in the context of a corporate entity and the ownership of a corporate entity. And I submit the court doesn't need to get there because it can consider an official, a general, who's carrying out a military function and is sued for carrying out that military function to be the state itself. And this court, in fact, said in the Sisipio-Puello case that a suit against an official was a suit against a suit in official capacity was a suit against the state.
We have some contexts where that doesn't reach quite as far as you say. I'm thinking particularly of Bivens, right? Those are actions against an officer, almost always acting within the scope of his authority, which the courts don't treat as a suit against the United States, but as a suit against the individual. And I guess you're arguing implicitly that the Bivens precedent represents something that should not be applied here. Why not?
Because in this case, Your Honor, we're dealing with a statute, and the statute defines the terms of foreign sovereign immunity. And this,
yeah, but you do have to deal with the statement of Dole that it's determined as of the time suit is brought, right?
Well,
and certainly a literal reading of that means that the defendant was not within the language of the exception, within the definition of state.
Well, I'd have two answers to that, Your Honor. One is that Dole was interpreting 1603B, and this court may decide that, and has intimated in the past, that a foreign official who performs in an official capacity is the state, and therefore we're talking about 1603A, and that interpretation wouldn't apply.
I'm sorry, where did we say that?
That a foreign official is the state?
Yeah.
Well, Judge Friedman said it in the opinion when he...
Well, that's under review.
But in addition, this court said in the Sisipio-Puello case that a suit in an official capacity against a foreign official is a suit against the state. And I think, I'm not sure that that decision was cited to the court, Your Honor. Came up in the discussion of the Acri case, which was the follow-on case dealing with Sisipio.
Acri? I'm sorry.
Acri, A-C-R-E-E. The plaintiffs discussed it.
Oh, and that's the, I'm sorry, A-R-C-E?
No, not R-C-E, Acri, A-C-R-E-E. And it was a case I believe the plaintiffs discussed in their reply brief. In addition, Your Honor, what was interpreted, the part of Section 1603B that was interpreted was the language is owned. And the court said that that language was in the present tense and therefore required a determination as of the time of the lawsuit, which made sense because if a government didn't own the corporate defendant at the time of the lawsuit, it's hard to see how the government could be liable or affected by the lawsuit.
Well, it could be affected in the sense that liability prospect of liability would have an effect on what the government could realize when it sold the corporation.
Right, but in this case, the corporation was already no longer, it was no longer.
No, but
yes, I understand what you're saying.
Adopting a rule such as the court adopted at Dole means that governments that own corporations, in a sense, suffer the losses from later litigation that are only realized in later litigation.
But in the context of 16057, Your Honor, and that is the exception to the Sovereign Immunity Act for state sponsors of terrorism, the court, and it's the liability of state sponsors of terrorism for the official acts of their employees. The court said that the status of the state as a state sponsor, or the statute says, the status of the state as a state sponsor of terrorism is determined as of the time of the acts in question, unless the designation comes as a result of the act in question. And that is really a closer context where we're focusing on what is the liability that attaches to individual acts and not corporate acts in this circumstance. Were the court to say, as Judge Sentell suggested, that sovereign immunity evaporates at the time that a foreign official leaves office, there would be a loophole that would consume the statute. It would no longer be the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, it would be the Foreign State Prosecution Act. And Tony Blair, when he came to this country, would be susceptible to a lawsuit because, after all, he's no longer prime minister. And if the United States courts can second guess.
Don't give them any ideas, counsel.
In addition, Your Honor, with regard to the personal capacity aspect, the plaintiffs rely on a number of cases that deal with the FLATO Amendment. The FLATO Amendment said that an individual employee who of a state sponsor of terror could be liable. And this court said that when such a person was sued, that they couldn't be sued in their official capacity because it was an act of the state, but they could be sued in their personal capacity. And the plaintiffs say, therefore, this suit must be in a personal capacity. The difference is that in that context, we are dealing with a state sponsor of terror, which is not entitled to sovereign immunity. And in this context, we are talking about the application of the Sovereign Immunity Act, and this court has articulated the standard in the Alfado case. And in the Alfado case, the standard the court articulated, even though the plaintiffs there claimed to sue the defendant in his personal capacity, the court said, the question is whether the acts are personal or private or for the benefit of the state. And that is the standard that Judge Friedman applied, and I submit that it is the correct standard in interpreting the act.
Counsel, I'm not turning up either this Scipio case or the, if I've got even got the word right, or the case that talks about it.
I think the Acri case versus Republic of Iraq is cited at page 35 of our opening brief.
Oh, okay. You're open.
No, the plaintiff's opening brief.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay. And that will lead us to?
The Scipio case, Your Honor. With regard to the Torture Victim Protection Act, Your Honor, plaintiffs claim that it's clear that it abrogates sovereign immunity. It doesn't say so. The Sovereign Immunity Act is clear, too. It says that subject to existing international agreements, a foreign state shall be immune from the jurisdiction of the courts of the United States. And then it said, except as provided in other sections. This isn't an exception. The Torture Victim Protection Act isn't mentioned. When Congress wanted to abrogate sovereign immunity, it knew how to do so. It did so when it rescinded sovereign immunity for state sponsors of terror, and it did so as an amendment to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which this was not. And again, if I've directed the court to the Scipio case, when you look at that case, you see that the court draws a distinction between a statute that creates a cause of action and a statute that waives sovereign immunity. And it said that the Flato Amendment and the 1996 changes to the Sovereign Immunity Act waived sovereign immunity, but did not create a cause of action against the state. This is the opposite. This created, the Torture Victim Protection Act created a cause of action, but didn't waive sovereign immunity, and the legislative history recognized that. So, Your Honor, were this court to hold that officials could be held responsible in U.S. courts merely because they were no longer in office, or merely because the plaintiffs alleged that their actions were illegal, this country would be disabled from arguing in other courts in other countries that its officials cannot be held liable for actions that could be challenged there. I think that implicates both the sense, the common sense of the statute and the political question doctrine. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel. Yeah, your time was up, Ms. Chomsky, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If you want.
I do, Your Honor. I'd like to point out to the court that the first secretary of the U.S. Embassy, the Lebanese Embassy to the United States, Waleed Haider, is in the courtroom. The TVPA is a suit for, is a statute that permits suits against individuals in their personal capacity. They do not, we are not claiming that it abrogates the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, because the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act deal with suits against the state and not against individuals. If this letter from the government of Israel were sufficient, it would mean that a foreign sovereign could divest this court of jurisdiction over a claim made under a federal statute in a U.S. court.
One might assume that, as under the Westfall Act, the position taken by the state sovereign is reviewable, but you haven't made that argument, really. And I'm not sure whether there'd be any imaginable basis for reversing it.
I'm sorry. I believe the Westfall Act deals with issues that are issues of the separation of power, which aren't at
issue. It deals with the question of who's the right defendant when you have a suit that is nominally against an individual, and the government says, no, we take full responsibility.
Yes, the U.S. government.
And that normally prevails, although it is subject to review.
If I may direct the court's attention to what was in front of the court in Velasco, which is a case that was cited by the defendant. In that case, the court had in front of it not a letter, but an affidavit with supporting documents talking about the defendant's authority within the statutes of that country.
No, before the FSIA, courts generally ruled on sovereign immunity based on letters from the State Department of the United States.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does the statute really change the ability of the courts to look at letters from diplomatic letters?
I believe that prior to the FSIA, they looked at letters from the State Department of the United States, not the letters from a foreign sovereign. Thank
One
you.
One more question, although your time's up. Mine's not. Did you argue below this notion of sovereign immunity ending at the time of the resignation of the official, at the end of his term in office?
No, we did not. It is within the court's discretion, of course.
Why should we look at it? The norm is, and it's a strong norm, I assure you, that we do not look at issues that were not raised below. What is it that makes this the extraordinary case in which we should look?
There are several factors. One is that this is a pure issue of law, not an issue of fact. This is a matter which the court would review de novo. The defendant has an opportunity to present its position.
That last one doesn't take it out of the norm. I mean, the norm is they would have a chance here. The other two, you might have some argument that that is a reason.
And in additionally, this is a matter of statutory interpretation that has ramifications outside this specific case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Recess.